I think a really great memoir brings both us into the other person's life and experience and resonates with our own as well. I definitely had that sense as I read Revertigo, an off-kilter memoir. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Author Floyd Skloot graduated from Franklin and Marshall College with a bachelor's in English and then completed a master's degree in English at Southern Illinois University, where he studied with the Irish poet Thomas Kinsella. From 1972 until becoming disabled by viral-borne brain damage in 1988, Floyd worked in the field of public policy in several states. He began publishing poetry in 1970, fiction in 1975, and essays in 1990. He's the author of nearly 20 books, his most recent being Revertigo, an off-kilter memoir, and that was published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Floyd Skloot, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Judith.
It's a fascinating book, and I think the fact that you write poetry is no surprise because it's a very poetic book, even though it's not written in a poetic form.
Well, thank you. I feel that I'm a poet first, despite the fact that I also write essays and memoirs and fiction, and everything arises for me from the poetry, from images and from a sort of compression and tightness and spareness, getting right to the point.
And yet, painting pictures, I think. I mean, there can be spareness that's not very visual, but you really paint a picture of your experiences that I think bring us into them, whether we've shared those specific experiences or not.
Well, thank you.
And the book is divided into three sections, each representing significant periods of your life and each having its own element of being off balance. Let's start with your childhood. It was not what would be considered an average childhood.
It's true. I'm the son of a very mismatched couple. And my mother left school when she was in the ninth grade, was stuck in a kind of fantasy of wanting to be an aristocrat, wanting to be a star of stage and screen, and had this very rich fantasy life of what should happen to her. And her husband, my dad, was a chicken butcher, and he was not part of that program, but that's who she ended up with.
How did they end up together?
I have wondered that all my life. I had to write a novel in order to try to imagine how they ended up together. My father died when I was young, and my mother, even before she succumbed to complications of Alzheimer's, was not a trustworthy narrator of her life. I know that they met at a hotel in upstate New York in the late 1930s, and that's about all I know. Mm. So I had to imagine what would have brought such unlikely people together, what would have kept them together, what would have made them think that it was a good idea to have children.
It's interesting because last week we talked with George Morgan, who's the author of Rocket Girl, which is a biography of his mother, who was the first female rocket scientist, and he knew almost nothing about her life as he was growing up with her, and it was in the course of writing her obituary that he realized that there were these huge mysteries about her life that he didn't know. So maybe this is a more common experience than I ever thought.
Well, I think it was possible to get a baseline of truth about both of my parents' lives. I had lots of aunts and uncles on my father's side, and was able to get some of the story of who they were and what their lives were. But I had to go around the original sources to get there. Mm-hmm. The way I look at it, my childhood wasn't a world of fixed principles or firm beliefs or trustworthy foundations. It was this mercurial, eruptive, shape-shifting place, theatrical, mm-hmm. melodramatic, and it was full of sudden harm because my mother particularly was extremely violent. Mm. And changes of fortune, changes of character. I mean, I never felt firmly grounded to the earth or connected to the people around me who often seemed to morph into somebody else. It was a time when, as an adolescent, you seek to create a stable identity and everything around you is just very unstable. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I learned about love, I think, through musical comedy lyrics, you know, great Broadway shows, South Pacific and The King and I.
Well, and you bring up The King and I, and that the way that you write about your experience of being in a production of The King and I that you really got forced into because your mother wanted to be in it and you couldn't be left alone at home.
Well, that's correct. My father at that time had been in the hospital for most of a year and would remain in the hospital for another year, recovering from catastrophic injuries that he sustained in a car accident. And I was of an age when I could have been left alone at home. I was 12, I think, if I remember right, at that time, and could have been left at home. I promised I would do my homework. I promised I wouldn't make a mess and that I wouldn't watch too much television. But my mother felt safer having me there, so I was cast as one of the many royal children in the production of The King and I, which was directed by a woman who had also cast herself as the king. So we had this woman playing the Yul Brynner role, and it was all very confusing for someone just coming of age.
Well, and do you think on some level, Floyd, that your mother wanted you there as an audience to her performance? Because this is really what she felt she was born to, was to be, you know, this presence on the stage, whether the stage was a theatrical stage or the stage of life.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think she probably did, to the extent that she thought about me at all or anybody else besides herself. Yeah, she probably wanted that to be the case. But, you know, growing up in an environment like this and participating in an activity like that, I began to understand as I started writing ReVertigo that my past, my experience was filled with things that kept me off kilter, that threw me awry and required immediate and quick adaptation and adjustment, much as by the time this Vertigo episode struck me in 2009, you know, when I'm 62, that required the same sorts of things. It was like good training, the childhood mm-hmm. that I had for making quick adaptation,
right.
Quick adjustment.
Well, and I found it fascinating that you talk about the backstory of The King and I, or Anna and the King of Siam. You know, I think because you do such a good job of weaving these threads of being off balance, being off kilter through all of these episodes of your life that you describe. The backstory of that particular stage piece is as convoluted as a house of mirrors.
Well, it is. And it's all about the fabricated life, the fantasy life that the woman whom Anna, the main character in The King and I, is based on. She fabricated her life, much as my mother hoped to fabricate her life, and really much as we all do, maybe not to the extent of Anna or my mother, but we all try to fabricate a life for ourselves, make ourselves be who we want to be. Sometimes we are able to deal with reality, sometimes we're not, and my mother was not.
And also the story, I can't remember the exact order, but The King and I was like first a book and then a play and then a musical or some order of that. I mean, it was going through these constant revisions to the point of, you know, almost playing telephone. The end product has very little to do with where it started.
Yes, it began as a memoir by Anna. But it was a memoir that was a tissue of lies. She just created a story, a backstory about herself that bore very little resemblance to the truth, and a history of her of Siam, as it was known at the time, mm-hmm. which bore little resemblance to what really happened there, and same thing with the king. And then that fabricated memoir was turned into a novel, a very famous novel, which in turn was read by filmmakers and playwrights and musical creators, mm-hmm. and turned first into a movie, and then from the movie was turned into the play. So, and then we've seen the musical comedy version of,
right.
The King and I turned into a dramatic play, the one with Jodie Foster. So it continues to morph.
Right.
And to me, that's a great metaphor for the vertiginous life. Things just keep, every time you think something's stable and real, it shifts.
We're talking with author Floyd Skloot. He is the author of nearly 20 books. His most recent, which we're talking about today, is Revertigo, an off-kilter memoir. It was published by the University of Wisconsin Press. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. We haven't quite gotten to that part of Floyd's life yet, but we will be talking about his very severe case of vertigo. If you've ever had vertigo, we'd love to have you share that experience with us. Or if you're really feeling a connection with what Floyd's talking about feeling off kilter or off balance through large portions of your life, whether literally or figuratively, we'd love to have you share those experiences too. Floyd, you talk about passing along the legacy of deception as a social tool. In that play, in your experience of that play, how did that mirror your childhood?
Wow. Could you say that again?
Sure. You wrote it. You said passing along the legacy of deception as a social tool.
Yes, that's right. Anna is doing that when she sings about deception to her son. The result of this deception is very strange to tell. She has a whole song based on teaching her son that it's a real good thing to put on outward airs, to fabricate being happy when you're sad, to pretend you're in control when you're not. And she's just passing on a kind of legacy of deception. And I'm not sure how that applies to my own life. I hope it doesn't, since I'm writing these memoirs that are intended to be absolutely true.
Well, your mother really used deception as a social tool, it seems like.
Yes, I guess that's a good point. She really wanted people to perceive her as this aristocrat, as this sophisticate. And it was a great struggle for her sometimes to keep up the front, especially with people who were themselves of a higher class, mm-hmm. or who were themselves well-read, and it was hard for her to put forth the fabricated story when they could ask a question or two and see through it. So mm-hmm. it was a very difficult stunt for her, and I think it culminates in the last chapter of the book called The Famous Recipe, when an old friend from the past, a woman who had been engaged to my brother nearly 50 years ago, discovered a recipe book that had been put out by a local group on the little island where we lived, and it contained a very strange recipe contributed to the cookbook by my mother. And my mother never cooked. The stove was used to store dishes and wrapped in plastic, and okay. I mean the oven was, and she just didn't cook ever. And for her to have to create and contribute this recipe to a cookbook was in itself a tremendous act of deception.
Right.
And then the recipe itself was so cockamamie that it blew my mind. I mean, it called for thinly pounded, thinly sliced veal cutlets to be cooked for nearly 3 hours. it was as though she had taken a recipe for, I don't know, brisket of beef and just put the word veal in instead,
wow.
or something.
Because veal would sound more high class and aristocratic.
Much more high class.
Yes.
And then she gave it a very fancy name, veal Italien scutini, and contributed it. And it was on the same page as a recipe for leftover tongue and stuffed cabbage contributed by other mm-hmm. members of the group. But there's my mother's very fancy, sophisticated, European-sounding recipe that would kill you if you tried to actually
right.
eat it.
And right.
and so I went ahead and made the dish with some modification to see what would happen, to see if I could carry out her intention mm-hmm. of doing something culinarily sophisticated without, in fact, making a fool of herself.
Hmm.
And that's the sort of culmination of the book, to kind of find a way to make her biggest fantasies enacted.
Mm-hmm. Floyd Skloot is the author of Revertigo. It is an off-kilter memoir, and he is joining us today to talk about that. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with the author of another fascinating memoir, Revertigo. Floyd Skloot joins us by phone. And Floyd, there's so much to talk about in your memoir, but I want to make sure that we get to part three. We'll hopefully be able to go back to part two, which talks a lot about your love of words and how you fell in love with literature. But part three of the book is A Spinning World, and it takes us through your experiences with ongoing and severe vertigo. First of all, explain what vertigo is technically.
Well, vertigo is the sensation that the world is spinning, that the world outside you is spinning, or that you're spinning within the world. It's not a disease itself. It's not a diagnosis. It's a symptom of a larger failure of the balance system. But it's that spinning sensation.
And you say it's not a disease itself, it's a symptom. What can it be a symptom of?
Well, that's where it gets pretty scary when you're presenting a doctor with those symptoms. It can be as grave as a symptom of a stroke or a lesion on the brainstem, or, you know, it could be really a result of something very grave. It can be something associated with the development of little calcium deposits in the inner ear, which is called benign positional paroxysmal vertigo. It can be an imbalance in the fluid in your inner ear. It can be a buildup of pressure in the brain. There are a number of diseases, and there are a number of illnesses of which this is a hallmark. And part of the process of figuring out why a person has particularly protracted vertigo is ruling out all these graver, more difficult illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
The most common is this benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, BPPV, which is what I was initially diagnosed with. And that's when these little calcium deposits form in the inner ear, sending signals throughout your system that are confusing and make it impossible for you to sustain your balance and make the world begin to spin. And that was initially what I was diagnosed with. It turned out not to be the case.
Describe that first episode of vertigo, you know, how it hit you and what was going on in your mind. It's a very unsettling feeling to suddenly, you know, have none of those cues that we rely on for where we are and where our body is in relation to the rest of the world.
It's so disorienting. You become, in a sense, disembodied, but stuck in your body. This came for me completely out of the blue. I woke up at 6:15, you know, there were no warning signs. I got out of bed and the room was spinning. I lurched to the bathroom and back. I was grabbing at the walls and door frames to support against what was swaying and swirling all around me. It felt like I'd been tripped by a ghost getting out of bed. And I ended up on the floor in the bathroom and had to kneel in order to put on my shirt. And I mean, I just couldn't move. I was grabbing onto things, and it seemed like everything I grabbed onto itself was moving and unstable. It was horrifying. I could not right myself and keep myself up.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in part because it came out of nowhere, it was so terrifying. But there was another layer for me, which was, as you mentioned in your introduction about me, I had contracted a virus in 1988 that targeted my brain and left me totally disabled. And it took me 15 years after that attack to get to walk without a cane. I had balance issues from that, but it wasn't vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
It was issues related to my brain processing messages that it was receiving from various systems in my body. And I also had severe neurological complications and cognitive dysfunctions, which have never gone away. But once I had gotten all through the balance issues, the 15 years from that original virus, I put away my cane, and it never occurred to me that I would need it again. And then to wake up this morning and have these symptoms in full flower out of nowhere and worse than they ever were was terrifying. I mean, I wasn't sure if my original virus was reactivating and was going to be worse than ever and render me speechless. I really didn't know what was going on, and that contributed and sort of echoed the sense that everything was off kilter, everything was out of balance. You know, the world is always spinning. I mean, the Earth turns on its axis at a ridiculous rate of speed, and it goes spins around the sun. And we don't ever feel that. Well, the combination of gravitational forces and our own balance system makes it seem as though the world is still, and we're still, but we're not. And when something like vertigo strikes, all of a sudden, I don't know, there's two ways to look at it. Maybe you're more in tune with the reality of the world, which is always spinning, and that stillness is just an illusion.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
But it does feel like you're broken, and right. that everything that's familiar, everything that's stable, is not. Mm-hmm. And you're at risk. I fell down the stairs in our home. We ended up selling our home and moving into a condo so that I wouldn't have to do stairs.
Which, as I recall, you even realized that the height of the condo could be a problem for how dizzy you would feel being in it.
Oh, I was so cocky. Yes, I thought once vertigo had disappeared again that I didn't have to take into account factors like, is there any residue? Are there any limits to what I can do now that I'm no longer walking with a cane? And yes, as soon as we looked at we visited the office of a condo sales company, and it was on the 29th floor, and I just went reeling through the office like I was inebriated.
Mm. Wow.
So even when it's gone, it sticks its head out from the corner and says, don't forget about me.
Right, right. I'm still here, whether you want to believe it or not. We're talking with author Floyd Skloot about his memoir, Revertigo, an off-kilter memoir. And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We do have a couple people on the line who would like to join in. So let's go first to Joan in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I unfortunately did experience a rather nasty episode of vertigo during a trip to Washington, D.C. For the occasion of my nephew's wedding. This was last June. It was quite frightening, really, very similar to the story that your guest had related. This was the first episode and the only episode that I've had of vertigo. And I ended up getting a lot of help from family members. I was able to obtain the appropriate anti-vert meds, which allowed me to actually still attend my nephew's wedding, because this occurred at 2 a.m. In the morning. It was still present at 4 a.m. At 6 a.m., I was able to phone my brother and let him know that I was having this difficulty, and I was able to obtain the appropriate meds. And was actually able to attend, which I was really grateful for. But I had actually sustained a bump to my head the day before. We were actually touring in Washington, D.C., and I was on a subway, and the subway began moving, and I wasn't actually in the subway seat at that point. And so I sort of got clunked on my head. I don't know if that's what caused it or not. That certainly was an unusual occurrence, and I haven't had this occurrence since. I'm grateful that it went away. I was able to get rid of the symptoms immediately. A relative of mine has had vertigo, and he indicated that, my brother, this is, he indicated that it actually took 2 weeks for the symptoms to go away at night. He was okay during the day when he took the meds, and then during the evening hours, it was spinning again, which I did not have that experience. I was actually quite fortunate.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that, Joan. And Floyd, you know, it's there are a lot of reasons, as you said, why vertigo can happen, but kind of regardless of the reason, it can be pretty terrifying.
Well, it is terrifying, especially when you don't know why it's happening. In response to your caller's comment, I'm not sure we covered this, but my vertigo lasted 138 days without stop. It was not a function of lying down or standing up or moving or not moving. It was constant around the clock for 138 days, just around 5 months.
That's almost unimaginable for me.
Well, it was and should have been indicative that what I had was not positional vertigo, the original diagnosis, since it never stopped. It wasn't a question of the position I was in. And same with a subsequent diagnosis, endolymphatic high drops, which is a condition having to do with the fluid in the inner ear being out of balance. Mm-hmm. Again, it didn't wax and wane as it would if that were the case.
Right.
So it's very hard sometimes for physicians or diagnosticians to pin down the cause because sometimes the symptoms don't quite fit a nice, neat mold. And mine, by being relentless and by lasting as long as it did, was pretty confounding.
So you said it lasted 138 days, Floyd. When you were in the midst of it, say, on day 137, with no knowledge that it was going to end the next day, was it hard to imagine that you were ever going to emerge from that?
It was very difficult. But, you know, I wasn't alone. My wife, Beverly, who's just been a tremendous force of support throughout our time together, was with me throughout this very closely, and she was very supportive. And she's a person of tremendous spiritual presence, and she believed that it would resolve. She believed we would get it. And when I was initially diagnosed with this positional vertigo, she helped me do all the treatments that were required, and that led us both to understand that it wasn't the disease that I'd been diagnosed mm-hmm. with. She was always there for me and always supportive, and I think I sustained hope by being around her hopefulness and her positivity.
And so after 138 days, it kind of ended as quickly as it came on.
Well, it did, and it was just breathtaking. In addition, let's see, by that time, I had seen my primary care physician. Then I had been referred to a balance specialist who worked in the field of neurology combined with the ear specialty called otology. And then with a neurologist who specialized in balance, and I had every test that they could throw at me, all of which proved beyond a shadow of doubt quantitatively that I was dizzy, but didn't establish why. And I'd also been going in for acupuncture and drinking ginger tea and doing everything a person could do to try to alleviate the symptoms. And what I do know is that it was a few days after my most recent acupuncture treatment when the acupuncturist decided to take a new approach in treating me. And he essentially said, I'm going to release the inner wind, something along those lines. All I know is on the night of August 12th, a few days after that, Beverly and I were sitting in front of the TV reading. The TV was off, but we were there reading, and I had this tremendous burst of pressure inside my head, outward burst of pressure, clogging my ears. And initially I thought that I was having a stroke, and then I was okay. And Beverly noticed the gestures I was making as I covered my ears and opened my mouth. And when we established that I was all right, she said, why don't you stand up? I bet your vertigo's gone. And I did, and it was.
Wow.
My neurologist, when he learned about this, had a perfectly reasonable explanation. He said, that tells me exactly what was wrong with you. And I know how to fix it if it ever comes back. He thought that indicated that what was causing my vertigo had been intracranial hypertension, a buildup of spinal fluid in the skull, because when my virus, earlier virus, reactivated, it plugged up the drains in that allow spinal fluid to flow from the spine through the skull and back to the spine, and it built up pressure.
So basically, he was saying that it probably was a symptom, a long delayed symptom from that original brain virus that you had?
Yes, a reactivation of the original mm-hmm. brain virus, although it could have been another virus. It could have been a cold that I had caught just before all this began. It could have been the reactivation of the chickenpox virus that I contracted chickenpox in my late 50s for the mm-hmm. first time. He said it could have been any virus, but a likely candidate was my original virus. But it could have been any virus, and viral material is sufficiently larger and could cause this intracranial hypertension. Mm-hmm. The only problem with his diagnosis, I discovered later, is that I didn't have all the symptoms of that either.
Mm.
I just had the vertigo, but I didn't have a buildup of pressure behind the eyes, causing my eyes to distend, and there are a number of other symptoms of intracranial hypertension that I didn't have. So to me, the end result is, from a medical standpoint, why it was there, what happened to trigger this relentless 5-month attack of vertigo isn't really known yet. It does seem to be something to do with a virus, but that's the only point in which everybody agreed.
Mm.
Whatever happened was triggered by a virus, but they couldn't quite label it, and then it went away.
Wow. We're talking with Floyd Skloot about his memoir, which is Revertigo, an off-kilter memoir, and Mike in Oshkosh is up next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi.
A few things that I thought might be of interest to you. I originally had my first attack of the vertigo while I was in the military in Germany in about 1969. And initially, they didn't quite know what to do with me. They sent me to the military hospital in Frankfurt, and they determined that it was Meniere's disease, which one of the main characteristic is, of course, vertigo. And they did a test there and decided that that's what it was, and didn't have an exact treatment for it. When I got out of the military, I went to the University Hospital in Madison. They did additional testing, and back in those days, there weren't too many options. One of the things that was suggested was because of the pressures in the inner ear, lay off of no caffeine whatsoever and absolutely salt-free diet if possible. And that seemed to be somewhat effective, but I continued to have episodes occasionally. Knock on wood, I haven't had one in about 10 years now. Mm. But the other interesting thing was when I got out of the service, I went back to university to continue my education, and I had a course in human physiology, and they were demonstrating different mechanisms in the human body, and one of the things that they did was to induce vertigo. And I said, oh, thanks, I think I'll pass on that. But if you're interested, what they did was, now they would take a few drops of ice water, eyedropper full of ice water, and tip your head to one side and pour the ice water into your ear. And it is extremely effective. In fact, that's what they did at the military hospital in Frankfurt, and you instantly have this vertigo.
Wow. Well, I'm not sure how many people will want to actually experience it, Mike, but that's very interesting. Floyd, have you heard of that as a way to induce vertigo?
No, nor would I be interested in giving it a whirl.
Right.
I remember the balance specialist saying, from now on, don't get on a boat. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of other ways one could induce vertigo easily. After what I went through, my own experience says I would never want to play with that at all
mm-hmm.
in case it stuck, you know?
Like, right. Oh, yeah, especially
child,
in your condition.
Told, don't cross your eyes because you won't ever get them uncrossed.
Right, or your face is going to freeze that way.
Yeah.
So, Floyd, we have just a few minutes left, and I don't want to leave people hanging. Where are you at now with your health and with the possibility that that you could, again, revert to vertigo?
Well, my health is always a work in progress. I think I'm doing fairly well right now, and I've had no signs of vertigo other than these sort of residual things I was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
So I can look out the window. We live in a condo on a river, and I can look across the river to an island where there's a heron rookery. And if I am not careful and I get too caught up in watching the herons land and the branches shake with them, I can get myself pretty dizzy just doing that. So I'm vigilant, but I haven't had vertigo in the now almost exactly 5 years. March 27th will be my 5-year anniversary of being vertigo, when vertigo began for me. And I haven't had a recurrence. And you just can't walk around worrying about it. So I'm carrying on. I watch my diet. I try not to put myself in situations where I might contract a virus and where my immune system is down and so forth. I just do everything that a sensible person would do to protect myself. And so far, so good.
Well, we certainly hope you fly past that 5-year anniversary and keep going without another episode. I want to let people know, Floyd, that you're actually going to be in Milwaukee at the end of April, Tuesday, April 29th. You'll be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee at 7 p.m. So there's so much more to your story than we've been able to touch on today. I hope that people in the area will be able to come out and see you and hear you talk about it.
Well, thank you. And can I put in, do I have time to put in a quick plug for two things?
Sure.
One is to thank very much the University of Wisconsin Press for publishing ReVertigo and for doing it in such a beautiful way and for being so supportive as the book is now officially out and beginning to get review attention. And this is my 18th book, and I know enough to know how good a job they're doing as a publisher. It's a great press.
That's good to hear.
And the other plug is, if any of your listeners are among the very few people left alive who have not read my daughter Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and you have to choose between the two books, try to find a way to buy both.
There you go. And I know that your daughter has been on Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about that book. So it's a good audience to be reminding of.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Floyd. Floyd Skloot is the author of ReVertigo, an off-kilter memoir. As he said, it was published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And there is a link to the book on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Well, coming up next, I hope you'll stay tuned, because we're going to talk with the author of My Queer Life. Callan Hardy is the author and details his experiences as an out gay man in Wisconsin. You know, being given a look into someone else's most private thoughts and experiences is a real privilege. We had that with Floyd, and I'm sure we will enjoy that with Callan. So stay tuned right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.